Cardi B thing.
What Cardi B thing?
The Cardi B doing ASMR.
No.
It's great. She you can tell she really like feels it because she's like in the booth. There's like a video of her in the booth and she's like.
Yeah, I have to watch that now. We're rolling, but
she's like dressed like old timey for some reason in it. Like I think she had just gotten back from like a photo shoot. I think I feel the way about ASMR that people, like, women who, like, can't have, like, penetrative orgasms feel.
What, like they're, like, which orgasms?
Like a penetration.
PIV.
Yeah, a PIV.
Yeah.
Who can't pivot.
Right.
Yeah.
What about?
Oh. Like, there's something wrong with me that I can't. Like feel, I don't feel tingle the ASMR. From right, ASMR. Right, right, right. Yeah, it just sounds like people going like. But right. If I did that, like if some people heard me go, uh-huh. They'd like, I don't know, their head comes or whatever.
Yeah.
Do you get it?
No.
Oh.
No. You're not alone. Just like, you know, 80% of women can't have penetrative orgasms. I think it's a similar number for ASMR stuff.
Yeah. Broken women. Freud thought that, which is pretty hilarious.
Thought that women who couldn't have penetrative orgasms were broken.
Yeah, wrong. Oh, that yeah. It was like,
oh yeah,
because they were psychologically weak or something.
Oh yeah, Freud with his entirely functional cocaine penis that totally functions and isn't broken by cocaine.
I bet his dick worked.
Yeah,
he seems like one of those like sociopaths who just like is hard all the time. You know, one of those rock hard sociopaths.
Yeah, maybe so. Put a cigarette butt in your neighbor's ashtray. I think that'll be fine. Has anybody talked to the guest?
No.
I did like early this morning.
Okay, so we have confirmation that she's coming.
Yup.
Oh, good sound. How was the rest of the show? I bailed at the after the. I think I just missed the last set.
Yeah, it was fine.
Lane was awesome last night.
Yeah, Lane did great.
Lane was really good.
He did very bad at my show because my show was fucking bad because of the nerd burlesque
next door.
Yeah. Hey, welcome. There's a cat.
How are you?
Good, how are you?
Good.
Oh, hell yeah. How are you doing the interview?
Perfect for the pod.
Yes.
Oh,
sweet. It's however it goes.
It's really loose. We'll probably go, you know, minimum, what, like 45, like not longer than an hour and a half. Something like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. I don't know.
Are you squeezed for time?
No, I'm not squeezed for time. I'm just like, I don't know, do I have that much to say? An hour and a half?
I mean, it's extremely...
Or an hour. It doesn't have to be...
I mean, like, maximum... Like, we won't go... We'll stop ourselves if we do that. Okay.
We run out of... Yeah, okay. Good.
I am going to wear this.
Oh, for
do
sure.
Do it. Yeah.
Sweet. Yeah. Yeah.
I think it'll come through the audio, the fact that you're wearing it.
Sure, yeah. We can talk about it. Like, oh, we see your show.
What? Let's not mention it. Let's see how long we can go.
Just in... Yeah.
All right. I'm going to...
Okay, well, I'm just gonna follow your Oz lead.
Do you have any milk or cream?
I do, but it is spoiled, so don't drink it.
All right,
but it's in the fridge.
Why do you still have it?
That's a good question.
We have iced coffee. If you'd like
Susanna's gone to the house.
Oh, you do. Okay,
sugar.
Yeah, I can get you some. Sugar.
That doesn't have sugar in it already.
What?
It has a little. Oh, you put some in mine.
It's a beautiful fireplace.
Yeah, it's a great house.
Yeah.
The boiler visor was just lifted. Did we talk about that yet?
No, we didn't.
Very exciting.
Yeah.
Exciting times.
I always accidentally drink a bunch of tap water before I know there's boil advisory.
Yeah.
So I'm still alive.
If I'm hungover, I'll drink water in the shower.
Yeah.
Like just drink shower water. So yeah. Those are your headphones, by the way, if you want to get a sense of it's helpful to know whether or not you're getting picked up by your mic, if that makes sense.
Hello.
See?
Yeah, you're good at it.
Yeah. You're an expert. Yeah. And like the table is a little small, so we're all kind of gazing into each other's eyes while we talk, which is nice, I guess.
I'm going to go. Actually, I'm going to get some more iced coffee and water real quick while Benjamin's still setting up.
There's little teacups.
Okay. What about the plastic cups?
Oh, you can do that too, yeah.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. So generally the way we start these is I start rolling the tape the second anyone walks in. And so it's just kind of we're not going to have an introduction. So if you want, you could introduce yourself right now.
Okay. My name is Amy Irvin. I'm the co-founder of the New Orleans Abortion Fund. We provide financial assistance to people seeking abortion care here in Louisiana. And we have assisted more than 1,100 callers since we began making pledges.
How long have you been operating?
I co-founded the organization with Justin Yeblis in 2012.
And it's the primary source of funding is pledge drives, is that?
Individual donations, yeah. So okay. You may know us for all of our creative fundraising events that we do, including Sex Ed Bingo, Roar and Row.
Oh, okay, cool.
Say Yes to the Vest Fashion Show.
Yeah.
Game-a-thon.
Yeah.
So the vast majority of our fundraising is among individual donors at these very interesting events.
Have we started?
Yeah, I just wanted to kind of get some levels and get some context.
Get it popping?
Because, yeah.
So it's sort of patterned after a bowl-a-thon, except that the local bowling alley here wouldn't support us. So shit. We
which one? Fuck them. Mid City Lanes.
Mid City Lanes.
Yeah, all right.
Oh yeah, isn't Rock and Bowl owned by some super right wing dudes too?
Oh yeah, that makes
sense. I can see bowling not being the most leftist.
Even Rock and Bowl?
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, supposedly his politics around the Confederate monuments aren't so great either.
Mm-hmm.
So rather than a bowl-a-thon, as many other funds do, we do a game-a-thon, which is ironically held at Shamrock, the former...
the former Rock and Bowl, right?
Rock and Bowl. Oh,
that's so funny.
So we form teams and then ask our friends and family to make pledges to us like you would a bowl-a-thon or a walk-a-thon. Mm-hmm. And then we meet up on a day in April and play games. So we're at that point, we've raised most of the money and we're just there to celebrate. And we throw darts, play ping pong, pool. We hand out prizes. If you haven't seen our infamous awards, which are made out of vintage trophy bases with a bedangled speculum on top. you've
funny.
Missed out.
Yeah.
Bedangled is a great way to describe it.
Yeah. Yes. And so it's just sort of a way to celebrate the culmination of more than, nearly 2 months of fundraising. Mm-hmm. Last year, we raised close to $30,000.
Holy shit.
Yeah. So it is our largest fundraiser and probably the least visible of all the events that we do, but it's a lot of peer-to-peer fundraising. And so people actually getting the opportunity to talk with their friends and family and colleagues about why they're supporting the organization, why it's important to them.
Since I was I think probably 17, tried to have the basement of my bank account be whatever an abortion is in that state. I mean, I fuck up and, sometimes dip below that. But I remember in Minnesota, I was I need to always have $700 just so it doesn't turn into hundreds of thousands of dollars of debt.
Yeah.
Thinking about it from a pretty selfish
materialist
standpoint.
Yeah.
Right.
But yeah, I mean,
it's a good strategy. But in case, just in case, know that we're here.
Right.
To help
right.
You.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, great.
So,
or if
number one most in need demographic is Benjamin Hoffman.
But Brittany had mentioned that the New Orleans. How does the whole process work with the New Orleans Abortion Fund? From funding to application to deciding based on, I guess, need who gets the funds.
Mm-hmm. So we do a fair amount of fundraising, and nearly 100% of the money that we raise at those events go to funding abortion.
Mm-hmm.
There's a group of volunteers, the client services team, that take week-long shifts answering the calls to our cold line.
Mm-hmm.
And they're speaking with people that are you know, primarily seeking financial assistance, but others who are just seeking information and resources, and others that haven't had their first appointment. So they're not even sure where the nearest clinic is or mm-hmm. how much it might cost. So we're providing a lot of information.
Right.
But for those that have had their first appointment and they know exactly how much they need to return, there's mm-hmm. a 2-day, there's a 24-hour waiting period here in Louisiana. Yes. So it takes at least 2 visits, the first one for the ultrasound and the mandatory counseling, and then the second appointment yeah. for the actual procedure. So it's, we're assisting folks who are in need of money for the second appointment. And so we're talking with them about how much that is, how much they are able to contribute, how much they've been able to save and have in their savings account, and mm-hmm. who or how they might go about getting that money. So mm-hmm. we know, having talked with people now for nearly 6 years, that they're putting off paying rent, they're buying fewer right. groceries, they're not paying utilities. And unfortunately, they're having to ask friends and family for $25, $50, mm-hmm. however much that they're short. And you can imagine how that might feel, right?
Right. Of totally.
Perhaps you really wouldn't want to tell anyone that you're facing an unplanned pregnancy and considering abortion. And yet you are having to ask friends and family. So by the time people come to the clinic, they have made up their minds about what their decision is mm-hmm. and how they're going to proceed forward. And so it's just horrifying that abortion care is not covered by insurance mm-hmm. and people are having to go to such extreme measures to raise money to pay for a safe legal procedure.
Right.
And there's also a bunch of like hidden costs that you guys help with too, like childcare, taking time off work, travel expenses.
So yeah, on top of just the fee associated with the procedure, as I mentioned, there's a 24-hour waiting period. So that means 2 days away from work. That's two right. days on lost wages, perhaps an extra day of childcare costs. Most women who have abortion already have children. Mm. That's a national statistic that certainly is true here and certainly the people that we talk to. And yeah, you may have to spend the night or certainly have to travel, pay for gas. The way that we handle that is simply in those conversations that we have with callers to sort of assess the amount of money they're short, whether it's for the procedure, for the travel, for childcare, whatever, you know, the factors are in their case, and try to bump up the pledge as best we can. Mm. We have very limited resources. I am the first to say that an abortion fund is a Band-Aid solution. Mm-hmm. There is just not enough. We do not have enough money and resources to pay for all the procedures that, you know, folks are calling us for help for. So, but if we're able to, we bump up the pledge a little bit and then leave it up to the caller to decide how she's going to manage that money. Mm-hmm. There are other funds that do focus on what's referred to as practical support. So they may offer a ride to the mm-hmm. clinic or provide a gas card. Some of them might have an arrangement with a hotel in the area in which they can coordinate some of that. But we've always chosen just to provide a little bit more money if we're able to, and put that management of the money in the hands of the person that's calling us. Mm-hmm. We trust them to right. manage their money. They're resilient and they manage their lives in all sorts of ways. Mm-hmm. So that's how we've dealt with it.
How do you get the word out?
So the way that we promote or advertise the fund is mostly through the clinic. Because as I mentioned, we're not really able to help with that initial $150
right.
Because some people do change their minds. They might decide that, you know, they prefer to continue the pregnancy. So we can't, you know, help with that first $150 mm-hmm. knowing that some people do change their minds and we have limited resources. But for those who decide and need that extra money, then the staff will refer them to the fund.
Okay.
Also, we have signs in throughout the clinic. And certainly in the work that we do, outreach, the fundraising events that we do. We have a very nice redesigned website that people can visit and check out us there on Facebook. We're very active on Facebook. And certainly all of our volunteers are talking about their work, especially during sort of fundraising seasons. But we're out in the public a lot. You know, it feels as if I'm everywhere sometimes.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think that this community has really supported the New Orleans Abortion Fund and people are aware of it. But still, there's a lot of work to do in both raising money for the fund and letting people know it's a resource.
Yeah, I know. So Izzy was she was taking calls for a while, and then that's how... Oh, yeah, use the microphone. Yeah, that's how I found out about it, and I should know she found out about it from a friend. It was just sort of like a word-of-mouth thing that got me aware of it at all. And I feel like there is a pretty solid chance that you're going to hear about it if you're just sort of a like-minded person in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like the fact that it's called I know that you've been explicit about this in your work, but it's the New Orleans Abortion Fund. And that, I think that language in 2012, I think people, even Planned Parenthood was still kind of distancing themselves from the word abortion. So I think that's very important. And I think it's done a lot, at least I'm sure there are other organizations, but locally, just, I used to be someone many years ago that was like, I'm not pro-abortion, I'm pro-choice. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
And I think being pro-abortion is an important distinction from just, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. We had lots of conversations about the name. Mm. And we were advised by people not to include the word abortion, that perhaps, you know, it'd be off-putting or, you know. And we're like, well, that's actually part of the problem, that there's a lot of shame and stigma around abortion, and people are reluctant to actually talk about it openly. And so we first wanted to address that. But more importantly, we wanted to ensure that for the people that are seeking financial assistance, that they can find us. Mm-hmm. You know, there's so when you Google, you know, abortion or New Orleans abortion, like we pop up, like there's no ambiguity about what we're doing.
Right.
I hope that we're easy enough to find. Because also, you know, there's these crisis pregnancy centers that are very deceptive, and they often name themselves after clinics or give ambiguous, you know, they name themselves these ambiguous names, and it's very
basically
dishonest.
Put themselves directly next to like Planned Parenthood. Yes. And shit like that. Yeah.
Exactly. So we didn't want there to be any confusion.
Right.
We wanted to be very open and transparent and out there as far as like this. If you need help, we can help you. Mm-hmm. It's also true that in some communities, crisis pregnancy centers do offer at least some support in the way of like diapers or cans of food or things like that. And so for that reason, we haven't always been as aggressive in protesting them or speaking out about them. Because as I said, in some communities, they are providing help to people. Mm-hmm. But overall, like the main mission and their work is very misleading. Mm-hmm. And certainly there's a lot of work to be done about informing people and about crisis pregnancy centers and just directing them to abortion clinics. If that's what you're seeking, then here's a list.
Right. There's nothing inherently wrong about helping people through pregnancy if they were honest about abortion.
That one thing you mentioned about I forgot about that myth of like, the link to breast cancer and abortion. That sounds like someone who like saw a woman for the first time, like trying to make up a lie, being like, I think it might be connected.
There's always, I feel like cancer is this thing that people use to all diseases, people try to moralize them. Like that's what, especially religious mythology surrounding things that are stigmatized. It's like, no, cancer's from being depressed or cancer's from having an abortion.
Right.
People do that with a lot of stuff.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, those are like old, like myths, like,
yeah, but
like
they're
like Greek myths
powerful in people's minds.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like, there's something like in like the human psyche that's like, if you,
I deserve this.
If you right. do something wrong, your foot will fall off. And if you're a woman, your boobs.
You were born bad
you're
anyway.
You're going to have cancer boobs if you do the sin.
Right.
Yeah. I never thought about that.
I want to know more about your background, Amy. So you, where are you from and what brought you into this work? Have you already talked about that before Benjamin and I sat down? Mm. No? Okay.
No. I grew up in Central Ohio. My immediate family were farmers, actually. And when my parents divorced, I moved into the city. I was raised by a single mother who was working multiple jobs. And I was very much aware of how difficult that was for her to raise two small kids. She was 21 when she had both of us and was divorced by the time she was 27. So thankfully, my father was supportive in many, you know, financially supportive.
Right.
And so, but, you know, she struggled and that really, you know, did stick with me. I went on to college and, you know, graduated and I guess how I got into this work really was, you know, I've had two abortions myself. I had one when I was 21 and a college student. And I knew then, like, I was, you know, I was going to go to college. I was going to finish college and get a job and have some security. And so, and I really didn't speak about that decision or that decision to have an abortion for nearly 20 years. Despite the fact that I had worked at a clinic in Atlanta and supported women in that decision, I really didn't talk about my own experience, which I think is very true for a lot of people. There, as I mentioned, there's a lot of shame and stigma around abortion. And even, you know, as a 21-year-old, I felt a lot of shame. I was like, this really shouldn't have happened to me. Like, I know better.
Right.
Right, I know better. But it does happen, and contraceptives fail and all sorts of things happen that might lead to unplanned pregnancy. But, you know, 20 years fast forward, you know, I had graduated, I had a career. I had worked both in refugee resettlements and in, as a union organizer. And finally, you know, in 2010, 2011, I just said, took a break and decided to move to New Orleans. And again, found myself with an unplanned pregnancy at the age of 42. And this time around, I took a little time to think about it because I thought, well, this is probably, if I'm wanting to be a mother, like I have to make this, you know, like this is it.
Right.
And so I, in this case, I took some time to think about it and I actually asked some friends and I really thought about my role as a woman and what I thought about motherhood. And in the end, I actually decided that, you know, I was okay being single and I was okay without having children and that, you know, it was just okay.
Yeah.
Like not everyone has to be a mother. And I was really pretty happy with the life I had created for myself. So I did decide to terminate the pregnancy and I had that abortion here at the clinic, Women's Healthcare Center, which is now our partner clinic.
Okay.
And I remember the day that I went to the clinic for my termination. Again, it was a 2-day procedure. I remember sitting there among a lot of women and learning that many of them had traveled from Baton Rouge. Weirdly enough, one of the physicians had recently died unexpectedly. And so they had to transport and assist women in getting to the New Orleans clinic to be seen. And so there were a lot of women in the waiting room who were anxious about the fact that they were in New Orleans and they're, you know, they'd had to change their appointment at the last minute. They'd had to come up with extra gas money. They had to knew that they had to rush home to either meet the kids at the bus station or be home when their kids came. And also knowing that they were going to have to return the following day.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And having worked at a clinic, I also did some, when I was getting my master's degree, I did a project on parental consent laws. And so I was kind of familiar with the laws in other states. And, you know, sitting there in that clinic, as a patient, going and experiencing the laws here and listening to the other women talk, I was like, what the fuck? Like, what is happening here? And I remember a sign over the receptionist desk saying, no funding accepted. And I was familiar with abortion funds through my graduate program. And I had done, as I said, a study on parental consent laws. And I had interviewed a lot of stakeholders in Louisville, Kentucky, including the A Fund. So I was aware of funds. And so after kind of sitting with my own procedure and kind of, you know, like just coming to terms and my own feelings and emotions around that, I reached out to the clinic and I said, you know, like, how are you being supported by the community? Do you have a fund? And, you know, to her credit, the administrator at the time, Sylvia Cochran, said, you know, we're not much supported by the clinic. You know, there really isn't that support and we don't have a fund. And I said, well, it was kind of this moment for me of like, someone's got to do something.
Right.
And I guess that's me.
Yeah.
So, I knew where to go. I knew at least where to ask about starting a fund. And we are, you know, I reached out to some friends and I was aware of the National Network of Abortion Funds, which is a network of about 90 funds across the country.
Oh, wow.
And they put me in touch with Jesse Neablis. And so we met over coffee one day in the CBD. I remember Jesse pulled up on a scooter and she has red hair. And I was like, oh, this is someone I can work with. So over a cup of coffee, we just sort of committed to, you know, starting a fund that we would meet up again in a month or so. And that summer we put together the bylaws and made plans to start fundraising. And I should say that the first $500 that the fund, you know, had in his bank account was a donation from a friend of mine. And that was really my first kind of fundraising effort, was to sit down with a friend, a male friend, I should say, and say, you know, I want to do this and would you help me?
Yeah.
And he gave $500. And so that was the beginning. And our very first fundraiser was a yard sale out of the front of my house. And so we raised a couple hundred dollars and we've been raising money ever since. So it's
just like selling furniture and stuff.
Yeah, we were just selling our stuff. Like, just people donated their stuff and we had a yard sale. So,
what was that like? People kind of like, because I imagine there were probably some people like walking up being like, oh, yard sale. And then you're like, it's for abortions, everybody.
Well, I don't know if we may have told people, because I really do believe in transparency.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I guess, you know, I would hope that if someone asked, we were upfront about what we were raising money for. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't, you know, we were just.
I mean, you are selling something. So, like, they are getting something. And yeah, that's how.
Yeah.
Commerce works, I guess.
Then you do what you want with the money.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, that was one of the very first. And then we had an event each year in the fall. We do an event that talks about the Hyde Amendment, which is the federal ban on monies for folks, primarily on Medicaid, and it's renewed each year. Many people don't know about the Hyde Amendment, but there is an opportunity every year to vote it down, and it does affect so many people. But so in the fall, we have an event. It's now kind of evolved into the sex ed bingo, but the very first one was this sort of somber dinner thing and on a Sunday afternoon. I'm sure there was a Saints game on because we didn't know any better at that time to check the schedule. And it was so serious. There was just a handful of people that showed up and we were like, yeah, no, this is not going to work.
Right.
Like we've got to do something different. You know, both Jesse and I are not from New Orleans, which I think is significant that it took two people not from here to start an abortion fund in New Orleans. But we have obviously have support from many people within the community born and raised here. And we have, you know, the work has evolved to sort of take on, I feel, some personality of the city. So,
I mean, you're wearing a like a pussy costume right now. So, yeah. I
don't know Evolva. If that's
been
yeah.
mentioned. The medical term.
Yes. Evolva
is pussy costume.
How long have y'all been wearing the vulvas? Amy and the other New Orleans abortion, Winter and mm-hmm. other people I've seen at fundraisers are always wearing pussy costumes at marches.
Does this qualify as business casual?
Yeah. So we have about 5 of these. And they're, you know, when we're not wearing them, they're hanging up in the office as if they're art pieces.
Do they? Do you have to get them dry cleaned, or are they self cleaning?
Oh, you dumbass!
Sorry, I'm sorry.
But I have to give credit to our board member Jackie Kinnebrew. It was her idea, and we began. She bought the first one. And we wore it.
Who makes them?
So we buy them from a costume company in Brooklyn.
Oh, neat.
And I don't even know if that company is still around or not. But we began wearing them immediately after the 2016 presidential election. And mm-hmm. we wore it to a rally within that first couple of months when Vice President Pence mm-hmm. came to New Orleans. We were out there at the airport, and we had one on then.
I'm sure that made him very comfortable. Yeah.
I'm not sure if he saw it or not, but
he probably doesn't know what it looks like. He's probably just like a pink hot dog. Yeah.
Yeah. They are oftentimes mistaken for a hot dog.
Yeah.
But I find that they're well received, and people oftentimes want to hug me, yeah. touch me. They definitely want to get their selfie taken.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so we've been wearing them, you know, off and on, definitely to marches. And most recently we wore them during our efforts for Get Out the Vote. And so we were out there on the CBD handing out postcards and encouraging people to vote just because it's important. And this, you know, these elections, as is every election, but certainly under this administration and in this state, more people need to vote and vote their values. So mm-hmm. it's a good conversation starter and brings a sense of humor to the work that we're doing, which is, again, something that we've learned over these last several years, is that we have to make this topic accessible to people. Mm-hmm. And we do that then through humorous events and comedy and yeah. costuming. And
when I did the sex ed bingo thing, people were so drunk and so rowdy. Yeah, so much fun.
So you were the MC.
Yeah.
You were the MC for our sex ed bingo
this
event.
This past one, I had the, like a yeah, horrible head thing and couldn't do yeah. it. So sorry about that. But
you're an escort too.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you want to talk about like with that element of what NOAF does?
Sure, and you can tell us your experience as an escort.
Sure. Why don't you give a little introduction? Yeah.
So in addition to the fundraising, the outreach, and the work that we do during the legislative session and providing testimony, talking to the media, we also have a very robust clinic escort program and have over 250 escorts trained to ensure that people who are going to the clinic with their friends or partners, you know, they're able to, you know, to some degree get to the clinic without being harassed by the protesters that are there. Mm. And we have both local protesters and national protesters that come to New Orleans and always make a point of stopping, you know, stopping at the clinic. And that program really began in 2014, I think, when Operation Save America came, which is one of the most horrible of national organizations. Every year they choose a different city to harass.
Mm-hmm. Oh God!
That year they protested at 2 of the clinics here locally, also the local physician's office and her home. So together with Feminist Majority Foundation, we organized and provided some escorts then, and provided escorts on an as-need basis, but with the clinic closure in Metairie a few years ago, all of those protesters began to come to women's healthcare centers. So now we're providing escorting 4 days a week. And Olivia Anderson is the escort coordinator. She does a great job of, you know, getting folks signed up for shifts. And it's, you know, we've been doing it now for 2 years. And so it's a real testimony to the commitment of the community, who are the folks that are escorting are all volunteers and they're taking up shifts. And we rarely are not able to fill a shift.
Can you talk just for a second about, just to go back to the Hyde Amendment, do you know what the partisan breakdown? It seems like something that Democrats would continue to support, because I feel like Democrats kind of play into Republican hands in the terms that they agree to talk about abortion with, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So, you know, this is going on, right? Mm-hmm. Like this discussion of whether, you know, within the political sphere, how do we win? How do we win as Democrats, right?
Right.
And for some Democrats, it's throwing women's health and abortion under the bus,
right,
of like, well, you know, it's safe, legal, and rare, right? Or
right, exactly.
That was Hillary Clinton's slogan surrounding abortion for a long time, and she's changed.
But. Yes, she has changed. You know, so even pro-choice supporters sometimes perhaps don't feel that it should be paid for. That that's, they may be supportive of the decision, but you're going to have to come up with that your money
right,
yourself. It's not going to come from taxpayer dollars. So yeah. I don't know the exact breakdown, but certainly even within the Democratic Party, there is debate about this. And certainly here in Louisiana.
Right, for sure.
Many of these anti-choice bills are authored and submitted by Democrats here in Louisiana and overwhelmingly voted
right
for. That's why they end up at the governor's desk to be signed. Mm-hmm.
The reason I ask about partisan breakdown is just because, not to be like super negative about like partisan politics, but just to say that I think that, I mean, and I should phrase this as a question. Mm-hmm. Do you think that the Hyde Amendment is like a fertile ground for activism around it? Like, for example, I think a lot of people, if they knew that their Democratic representatives were supporting the Hyde Amendment, would be pissed. Like, I think it kind of flies under the radar in terms of the news cycle.
Certainly there needs to be a lot more education about the Hyde Amendment, that there's an opportunity to vote it down every year. Mm-hmm. And education about who the Hyde Amendment impacts the most. It's really a racist policy, right? Because it's impacting low-income folks that are typically on Medicaid, but also people that are getting services like through like Indian services, healthcare services, or military folks who are in the military, even Peace Corps volunteers are affected by this. So definitely more education about the Hyde Amendment, but education about all of these bills and the ways that they impact people within our communities, and whether it's a, you know, ban on insurance coverage, or most recently a 15-week ban, which was passed this year and signed by the governor. 24-hour waiting periods, you know, so even though on the surface some of these bills seem logical, if you begin to look at them more closely and critically, you begin to understand the impact they have on people's lives. And so I really don't care what party. I mean, I certainly, as a Democrat, I wish that folks here in this state would be more supportive of abortion access in general. But I think that, you know, from my point of view, abortion access is really about values, and it's about self-determination, moral agency, bodily autonomy. Mm. And those values apply to many issues.
The heartbeat bill in Ohio just passed the House.
And,
but what do you think the likelihood of that actually becoming law is?
I don't know enough about Ohio politics to say for sure, but, you know, the Midwest is becoming surprisingly conservative and is, you know, they're definitely passing a lot of anti-choice bills too.
That's terrifying. Yeah.
Yeah. It's terrifying.
Cause it's basically making abortion illegal, which would set a precedent that if it,
Well, and also in So that was at the state level, but also in the last, you know, during the midterms, Alabama and West Virginia passed two amendments that are essentially trigger laws, so that if Roe is overturned, then abortion becomes illegal in those states. And there's also a piece, I think it's in West Virginia, where it prohibits public funding for abortion.
I thought Louisiana had trigger laws.
It does.
Oh, yeah.
So we're one of four mm-hmm. States with existing trigger laws. So
cool.
Which is why this last several months have been very stressful, but you know, between a Justice Kavanaugh and his position on many issues, but including abortion. And also then the recent Fifth Circuit court ruling, which upholds the Louisiana admitting privileges law. And that requires physicians at local clinics to have admitting privileges at hospitals. It's really unnecessary because...
Abortion is safe.
Less than 1% complication rate from abortion. It's actually more dangerous to carry a pregnancy to term.
Right.
Especially in this state where there's high rates of maternal mortality and mm-hmm. infant mortality. But also, again, physicians who are providing abortion are licensed OBGYN or family practice physicians. They've been schooled and trained in this procedure and can deal with complications that might arise, and most of them can be dealt with at the clinic. Mm. If there is a complication, they have transfer agreements with local hospitals, so they can transfer a patient to a local hospital. You know, the anti-choice movement has been very smart in their strategy, and the admitting privileges bill has been so damaging. You know, in Texas, when it was introduced in, you know, 2012, 2013, I can't remember the dates now, there's a anti-choice bill every year. Mm. You know, in Texas, there were 40 some clinics, and it, you know, half of those clinics closed because of the admitting privileges bill, which then went on to the Supreme Court and was Whole Women's Health versus Hellerstedt. And the Supreme Court ruled in our favor, said that, you know, admitting privileges bills and other trap laws, what we refer to as trap laws, have no medical value. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was unconstitutional, which we've been arguing for years now. But the, you know, right here in Louisiana, the Fifth Circuit in this most recent ruling about the Louisiana admitting privileges law basically thumbed its nose at both the lower district court in Baton Rouge and the Supreme Court, both of whom said admitting privileges are unconstitutional. So if you want to talk about activist judges or activist courts, the Fifth Circuit in this case definitely has been activist-y.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's impossible to separate the idea of a judge from the idea of, like, having a political, mm-hmm. like,
bent
point of view. Like, yeah. It's absurd to think that there is any judge that's completely impartial. Like, that's...
Well, certainly not in this political climate where everything's politicized, but, you know, I think there's an assumption that judges put aside their personal views and rule based on the law.
Right. But the way, the way that they read the law is going to be, I mean, I think we're all just agreeing.
Can we just go back for a second to trigger laws for the sake of our maybe less informed listenership and me, my ignorant ass? What is a trigger law?
So it's written into Louisiana law that if Roe is overturned, that abortion is automatically illegal. Because with the overturning of Roe, then it gives more power to the states to make the decisions around abortion access.
And dumbass liber-fucking-tarians I had to talk to in college will be like, well, it would be up to the states and like all this states' rights bullshit. And I'm like, well, fuck you, because if you leave anything up to Louisiana, they're going to murder us. Like, they hate us. And so, like, the whole thing, that's always been terrifying. A lot of people don't realize that, like, if Roe v. Wade's overturned, they don't even have time to...
Right.
Yeah.
But, you know, so we do have a trigger law. Mississippi has a trigger law, as does North Dakota and South Dakota, I believe. And then now West Virginia and Alabama.
I'm confused about this. So if we lose admitting privileges, then will doctors be able to provide abortions if they choose to legally? Like, no, they can't. Okay. If even in a hospital, like personal private doctors couldn't. Because that's how rich women always got abortions before Roe, right? Mm-hmm. But it was illegal for them to do that then?
Well, so it's up to a hospital whether they provide that care or not. And certainly there are cases, medical reasons why mm-hmm. someone might seek an abortion. But as I mentioned earlier, the vast majority of abortions occur in these clinics.
Mm-hmm.
And while a private practice physician could offer abortion care, there was a change in law in which it restricts the number of abortions that private practice physicians can offer. So it used to be 5 per month before the state got involved, so 60 per year. Now it's 5 per year.
Jesus.
And then the state is going to become much more involved in wanting information and data from private practice physicians. So
what was the justification for capping that at all? Like, dude, like, what did they say?
Shoulder shrug.
Yeah, giant labial shrug.
Yeah. Just fuck them. It was their whole... Yeah. Damn. Because, like, most of the time, these arguments have to be couched in some sort of, like, either, like, misinformation or just, like, malice, I guess.
Religion, like, I only know this from being raised Catholic, but, like, that is Catholicism's only issue. That's all that they care about. That's I swear to God, that's all you have to do to be a Catholic is hate abortion.
My entire family despises Trump and voted for him.
Yeah, because of abortion.
Because of the Supreme Court.
Because you're going to go to hell if you don't. Yeah. I mean, that's what people are... I don't know if this is relevant or not, but I don't think the people who weren't... I don't think people realize... Like, people are like, that law is so stupid. And it's like, even Democrats here believe that abortion's the most evil thing in the world mm-hmm. because it's such a Christian... place.
Right.
Yeah.
But there are organizations like Catholics for Choice, right. and we've partnered with them multiple times to show films or conduct, you know, panel discussions. So just because you're Catholic doesn't mean that, you know, there isn't room for some education and some re-examination of this
just
issue.
The national level.
Yeah. Yeah.
On the national level, Catholicism. I mean, in my school, we had to watch an abortion video when we were like 12. Mm. Like, it's just, it's... Yeah, it was just a very crazy... Yeah,
we love to shit on Catholics in this podcast because we were both raised Catholic, but...
I'm not shitting on Catholics who are pro-choice, obviously. Well,
that's what I'm saying. Yeah. It's like it's important that Catholics know that there is a resistance inside the
inside church. Yeah, that is important. Yeah. I did not know that. I'm just saying, like, mm-hmm. it's... I mean, I... That's what... I don't know.
Well, my sister's Catholic now.
Ooh. Convert. Yeah,
crazy.
Yeah.
And there was an abortion clinic, like... a half a block from where she used to live, where there were just like awful, awful protesters, huge signs, the like, you know, amplification, just like screaming at a building like crazy. And she would always, she's like also like a very pugnacious person. So she would just like walk down there and just start yelling at them and like pull the "I'm fucking Catholic" card.
Yeah.
And like be like, I still don't be a fucking asshole.
Yeah.
Well, and I want to mention that, you know, the New Orleans Abortion Fund is working here in South Louisiana, predominantly Catholic community. And for the people that are calling us, they do identify as being Catholic mm-hmm. or spiritual in some way. And so it's very interesting that the folks that we're assisting identify in that way. And mm-hmm. so it's, you know, despite what the church says, it is their people
that are
seeking out abortion care.
Oh, definitely.
Care.
Yeah. I mean, my, one of my relatives who will remain nameless is very, like virulently anti-abortion. And she has gone with friends for them to get abortions and like held their hand. So it's like a very mixed, mm-hmm. There's a lot of ambivalence among Catholics, I would
say. It's hard to actually be anti-abortion when you're confronted with telling someone that you know that they have to carry a pregnancy
to
term.
That's my entire politics, is it's really hard to like screw someone over if you have to look them in the eye.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Which is why it's so important for us to talk about it openly and genuinely and among our friends, among our colleagues. You know, I talk about it as far as like kitchen table conversations mm-hmm. or... You know, just so that when the issue comes up or when it's presented, people have enough courage or knowledge or just genuineness, empathy to talk about it openly, to say, you know, well, what about this? Or I had a friend with the, you know, this occurred, right. Or I went with a friend and this is what happened, you know? To personalize it, it's, you know, for way too long, abortion has been sort of siloed off to the side, separate from healthcare, separate from everything else. And we see that, like, in even where you get an abortion, it's at this independent clinic that's not, you know, it's not in the hospital. Right. It's not even within your private practice OBGYN's office, you know. So we have to integrate it in into reproductive health care and also acknowledge that one in four women have had an abortion. And most of us know someone who's had an abortion, you know, in almost any room. There is a percentage of people in that space that have had an abortion. And, you know, they oftentimes may have never divulged that information or talked with their friends. And I understand that. As I said, you know, I didn't talk about my own abortion at 21 for years. But I think at some point you just say, fuck it. And, like, you know, people are making the best decisions for themselves at that time.
One of the most compelling parts of your work that isn't actually funding, like, abortions is, to me, the destigmatization effort. Like, it seems like it's an integral part of the work and also kind of an, not effortless, but, like, very integrated into the practice. So, like, because you were talking about that somber dinner that you had and you were like, this is horrible, you know, like, and then, and it seems to have gotten much more lighthearted. Can you talk a little bit about that, the thought process behind that?
Well, it was as much about making this issue accessible to people. And so therefore, you know, making the events fun, making, giving a sense of humor to it. Because that's sort of the way we roll here in New Orleans, right? But to be frank, I also couldn't do this work if there wasn't a sense of, you know, just play to it. Because it is very serious. And people's lives are being affected every day. And so in order, at least for me personally, to continue to do this work, I have to build in some of that for myself. I'm a creative person. You know, I moved to New Orleans thinking I would be involved in art and do more art. And instead, I started an abortion fund. So I've, you know, it feels like a very uphill battle oftentimes. I sometimes feel as if I'm talking to the wind and having very little impact. And yet we do provide a lot of financial assistance to people and have changed lives. And we have been in spaces, you know, especially during the legislative session, in which we're providing testimony and talking to media and putting out a different narrative that isn't often heard. And being in the community, just being out and about. And, you know, people have noticed that, you know, I can't hardly go anywhere without someone recognizing me and coming to thank me or just, you know, say, hey, I was at your last event. Thanks so much. You know, we were recently the beneficiary of the New Orleans Lady Arm Wrestling's brawl, their last brawl, which was so sad that they're going to be ending that now after 10 years. But, you know, we were the beneficiary. We showed up as Supreme Court justices. So I was Sandra Slay O'Connor, and we had Ruth Liss Ginsburg. And, you know, our wrestler, she lost in the first round, of course, because she doesn't wrestle. You know, she's not an arm wrestler. But the amount of support that was demonstrated, I mean, the place was packed. I think they estimated between, like, you know, close to 400 people were there. We raised $6,000. You know, with mostly, you know, the bedding and then the door and some merchandise and stuff. So it was just amazing. And, you know, in that moment, I just, again, sort of fell in love with New Orleans again and realized that there is a tremendous amount of support in this community. And it was an arm wrestling event, you know, so people are, you know, people do want to support organizations, support the work and have some fun while they're doing it. Yeah, I think that this community has been very supportive, and I've found community here in New Orleans through this work, which is both exhausting and exhilarating at the same time.
Totally. I'm interested in zooming out a little bit and talking about Roe and Kavanaugh. What is, basically, it seems that we need to keep Roe away from the Supreme Court at all costs right now, right? Does that sound right?
Yeah.
And
except that, as I said earlier, like, you know, one of the things we talk about, obviously, is, you know, access, and Roe is in place. You know, Roe is the law of the land, mm-hmm. and yet access to abortion care in Louisiana and across much of the South and mm-hmm. in many parts of the country is inaccessible. So, yes, we have to keep Roe in place because it would be much worse without it. Mm-hmm. But I think we need to recognize that even with Roe in place, people are not getting right. the health care they need.
Totally.
Hundreds of bills, anti-choice bills, have been passed at the state level. The attack has been at the state level, not the federal level. Right. And so, you know, organizations like the funds and other organizations that have been working on a state level have been fighting this battle now for years. And so, yeah, while we're concerned about Roe, the work is at the state level, mm-hmm. and there needs okay. to be more acknowledgement of that, more resources coming to the state level. And also, shame on the federal organizations for not paying attention more, you know? Right. So, you know, there's this, you know, certainly in this last midterm election, there was emphasis on overturning, you know, getting more people in the House, and we've accomplished that. Hopefully that will have impact. But we need to be looking at state houses mm-hmm. and state races and even the governor's races. As much as we get excited about federal races, people need to pay attention to local races, mm-hmm. state races. They need to be involved in those campaigns and those efforts, because it's those legislators, those policymakers that have the most direct impact on our lives. And certainly when it comes to abortion access, the Louisiana legislative body, are passing laws that are preventing access. And, you know, in 2016, there were more than a dozen bills introduced and 7 passed. And every year there is a bill that's passed, and multiple ones passed. That's a little wonky, but sorry about that.
No, it's informative and it's great.
I think the important takeaway from that, like, even if the details don't stick, for like all listeners, the important thing is that you think there's a disproportionate emphasis on Roe and on the federal level, and that there's not enough people paying attention at the, like, on the ground.
Absolutely.
Okay. We're getting a little low on time, so I wanted to end with like some super practical information and then like kind of a call to action for the people listening. So,
and I thought we didn't have enough to talk about.
Yeah, right. I'm telling you. Yeah. People always underestimate like our question asking ability.
Yeah, we have so many.
So I want to ask, what are the biggest misconceptions? Like, do you still work the phones?
I don't personally work the okay. phones.
But I mean, I'm sure that you'd still be aware. What are the biggest misconceptions of people calling? For example, like when I had a pregnancy scare, not me personally, but my partner, we had a pregnancy scare a while back. I was like, this is how ignorant I was. I was like, oh, there's like a pill now. I didn't know that there's, I thought that it was like super, like still, anyway.
A surgery.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, there's both medical and surgery mm-hmm. Options. But I think sadly, the biggest misperception is people call to say, is abortion available? Is is abortion legal in Louisiana?
Right.
Yeah. And the answer is,
yeah. Yes. Well, right.
Right. Yeah, technically.
Yeah.
Okay. So
better hurry. Yeah.
And then if you had like one thing you would encourage people listening to do other than donate to New Orleans Abortion Fund.
Yeah, thank you for that.
Yeah.
The most important thing in this moment is to donate, but because, you, as I said,
it's immediate.
It's immediate. Mm-hmm. 100% of the donations go to funding abortion. Mm-hmm. But I think really the most important thing to do is to talk openly and honestly about this issue with your friends. You know, there's so many ways and avenues and entryways into how you can talk about this issue. And I just encourage, whoop, that's my phone.
Oh, it was so nice.
I thought it was like an epic swell of music I had already edited. Yeah.
So, it happened so organically. Sorry, yeah, keep
yeah,
it going.
Yeah, but just to finish the point of like, it can be serious conversations. It can be political and policy oriented. And there's so many ways and entry points. And it can be fun, and it can be art, and it can be jokes, and it can be laughter, and it's, you know, it's our lives.
All right, so I think that's a good place to wrap. Donate to the New Orleans Abortion Fund. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you, Amy Irvin.
Thank you so much.
Link in the description, and we'll also link to All Above All in the description. So
thank you so much.
All right,
peace.
Peace.